3 weeks ago, we launched this series, I Don't Wanna, and we've said, what we've said so far is that no matter what someone believes about God or heaven or hell, we all know that this life, to some extent, is like an endurance race, that it has a beginning and an end, and that beginning and end is filled in between with obstacles and challenges. They're personal, they're relational, they're financial, they're emotional, they're spiritual. And one of the things that we all understand, again, no matter what we believe spiritually about anything, we all understand this idea of striving towards overcoming barriers in our life towards something that we perceive as next. Like, this is the next thing that my life needs to move towards, from birth to death. If you really think about what we're striving for, again, no matter what our race, our nationality, our bank account, our religion, our nationality, we're all striving towards the same two things. We are striving towards a sense of contentment and a sense of peace. That all of us, that we all long for, what we're all hoping that we will achieve by this next thing that we're striving towards, that once we reach that, is that we will feel, look around at our circumstances, and that we will look around at our lives, and that we will feel this deep, abiding sense of contentment and peace. And you may not be a church person, you may be skeptical about God or faith or church or Jesus, the Bible, any of that. You may identify as a nun, no, like N-O-N-E, not nun, you're not wearing the frock today, but no religious affiliation, but no matter what box you check, as a fellow human, this is something that connects all of us as part of what we call the human race. But as what we've said from the very beginning, the contentment and peace seems to be a moving target. That it's like we experience it for a while, but for one reason or another, it's only a matter of time before a circumstance or something comes along and that peace and that contentment moves away from us, and or it becomes a barrier to peace, because though we didn't choose it, we had no say in the matter, because as much as we don't want to believe it, our mom and dad decided to get busy one night, and about 9 months later, we were born into this world, into this thing called the human race. And we identified this in the first week, that we, even though we may not know it, we may struggle to believe it, we may struggle to understand it or accept it, the race that's laid out before us individually is laid out by God himself. The foundational passage for this series is found in the book in the Bible simply entitled Hebrews. And in Hebrews chapter 12, the author writes these words, "Let us run our race. Let us run our race with perseverance. Let's run with perseverance the race marked out for us." And again, whether you believe in God or not, you each know that you have traveled a path in your life, and much of it was out of your control, which is why you all know how to end a sentence like this, that you can't really understand someone until you have walked a mile in their shoes. That's right. So we get this. Because you and I, we were born into a country, not of our choosing. We were born on a date and time in history, not of our choosing. We were born into a family, not of our choosing, which was for better or for worse, that those environments and more we never have had control over. We never had control over. And it either helped or it has hindered us in our individual journey and race in this life. And as the author encourages us, though much of our path, much of our race was decided for us, this individual striving, the author encourages us that even though we didn't have control over that, we do have control over how we run our race. And no endurance race is pain-free, and we can run this race in such a way that we can win in this life and the next. So the author says, let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, and let's fix our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. So he is writing to people that are people of faith and that are facing difficulties. He's saying, okay, fix your eyes on him, because for the joy set before him, he endured the cross. And so for him, that was part of his race. And he scorned its shame. And he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners. In other words, there was a race that was laid out before him, and like some of us, there are people that were trying to interfere and trying to trip him up or get in the way of the race that was laid before him. He endured such opposition from sinners, and do that so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. There's going to be things that you face, even people that you face sometimes in your race. So in other words, our life, it's going to be difficult. And for some, more than others. But the difference is you can choose to either run this life aimlessly, you can run this life and guess your way through, hoping that there's more to this life than this life, hoping that if whatever God is up there, that I'm running my race and that I meet whatever bar and criteria that he has set, that I can make the cut with whatever God is up there. Or you can run this race trusting and following the one that God sent to show the way. You can run this way trusting and following the one that personified what it looks like to run your race and live a life with clarity and direction and purpose and to be equipped to overcome those things that would take us down, because every endurance race involves pain, but we have the power to choose. We get to choose the pain. We can choose the power, the pain of discipline or the pain of regret. Now, everyone in this room or listening online, you and I are going to face times where we want to throw in the towel. We just want to give up. We want to opt out. We want to tap out, which is, again, why the author encourages us to run our race with perseverance, to fix our eyes on those. In chapter 11, before this chapter, he describes a list of individuals that have run their race before us, and they have finished, to fix our eyes on those that have gone before us, on the one who have they've run their race, led the way, shown the way, persevered to the end, with Jesus being the ultimate example that the race that God marks out for us is rarely, if ever, a race we would mark out for ourselves. But it's one that offers a reward far beyond what we could ask or imagine. So this morning, what we're dealing with in this I Don't Want a series is, what does it look like to run my race as an adult and win? And most of you in here, you've reached that point. Because there are days where, as an adult, I don't want to adult anymore. And trust me, I am right there with you. I had to travel up to Wisconsin to help my mother, who lives up there, and she can no longer stay in the circumstances that she's in. And I had to travel up and get there, pack all day till it, late in the evening, get up and drive 13 hours back yesterday. I'm telling you, I did not want to adult anymore. I want to pass that off to someone else. But it's kind of funny. I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, and again, I realize some of you here or listening are kids. So, but when I was a kid, I couldn't wait to become an adult. Because as a kid, as I thought, becoming an adult meant freedom, right? like being an adult meant options, control, power, the ability to make my choices, to make decisions about my life, decide my own life. You know, being an adult meant money in the bank that I could spend the way I wanted. I could go where I wanted, when I wanted, the way I wanted, to just do and buy whatever I wanted. Nobody ever again would be bossing me around. You know, I could make my own decisions. No one controlled me anymore. And then the day came that I was an adult. And it was not exactly how I envisioned it at all. And for most of this, you know, in this room, or you're listening online, you get this. You understand this because, you have celebrated at least 18 birthdays, which makes you a legal adult, except Alabama or Nebraska. It has to be 19. In fact, as a little aside, I think that's about the only way, polite way, I've figured out how to ask a lady how old she is. How many birthdays have you celebrated? So see how that works out for you. But you know, isn't it true, like whether it was our eighth, you know, for those of us that have reached an 18th or a 21st birthday, you didn't necessarily magically feel like I'm an adult now. You know, especially if at the time you're still living at home with your parents, you know, or you're living in a college dorm, you know, and in our minds, we knew we had certain rights. Like, okay, suddenly now I can vote, or I can join the military, or we realized I could be tried as an adult, which for me at that age was a little concerning because I wasn't making the best choices at that point in my life. Or we experienced our 21st birthday, and we were so excited that we could now go out and buy beverages that before that were previously forbidden by law. But for most of us, it wasn't so much a birthday or a date on a calendar, but something that we experienced. Like there was a moment, a decision we had to make, an action we had to take, or something that we did, and it was like it suddenly dawned on us, like, oh my gosh, I'm an adult now. I'm becoming an adult. I feel like an adult. And for most of us, when that happens, it's both exhilarating and a little terrifying, all in one. In fact, in 2017, and I have had the opportunity to work with hundreds of amazing, amazing young adults, college age, early to mid-20s, even older, and so I know this to be true, that increasingly, individuals that fall in this age group are not, they don't feel like an adult. And for many of them, they're not operating as an adult. Even though physically and legally they've arrived, there's this increasing phenomenon. And in fact, in recent years, there's been a term that's been coined, and the term is extended adolescence. So more and more, there is a resistance to becoming an adult. And statistically, this especially applies to males, which actually I am very passionate about. And there's many reasons why this is true, but I don't have time to go into it this morning. But just Google it. Google the term extended adolescence, and you'll see all kinds of writings and articles and stories. Scientific American did extended adolescence when 25 is the new 18, or you'll see books like Manning Up, how the rise of women has turned men into boys. There was a Wall Street Journal article, Where Have All the Good Men Gone? One prominent university psychiatrist, she wrote this, 25 is the new 18, and delayed adolescence is no longer a theory but a reality. In some ways, we're all in a psychosocial moratorium, experimenting with a society where swipes constitute dating and likes are the equivalent of conversation. So in a culture, there's this increasing confusion and a reluctance to the term we're just going to use this morning, adulting. And we're addressing it this morning because adulting well matters, not just for us individually, not just for our sakes, but for the next generation that is watching and they are paying attention. And so we're addressing it this morning because in many ways, this next generation is struggling. And so what's at stake is not just us and our future, but the future of those that are coming up behind us and they're watching us, trying to learn what does it look like? What does it mean to adult and to do it well? Now, part of the challenge is, at least in Western society, especially in America, you are assumed to be an adult if you have crossed 5 key milestones, traditional milestones. They are leaving home, completing school, becoming financially independent, marrying, and having a family, unless an individual decides, makes a conscious decision to either not have children or they're infertile. So there's these milestones. But the problem is that not all complete these milestones, and for those that do, and this could even be some of you, more and more crossing over unprepared. And again, this might even be you, or there's somebody close to you in your life, you'd say, you know what, this describes them. Maybe this is you or was you, but increasingly young men and women are taking on the responsibility of adulthood without the clarity. And most of us, again, we could stand up and tell our story of taking on responsibility of adulting without clarity and some of the train wrecks that created in our life. And some are taking on this responsibility when they finally leave home and all that comes with that, or taking on college or trying to manage finances, or they're taking on the intricacies and the complexities of a romantic and a marriage relationship, or having children, and they're taking on increasingly adult responsibilities, feeling ready only to discover, I was not prepared for this. Now granted, there's some things that you only really learn until you, like you can read the books or whatever, you can read all the parentings, but until you possess a human that you created, you don't really understand. So yeah, there's some levels like we don't get that. But so over the next few weeks, we're going to dig a little deeper and gain clarity as to what it looks like to win as an adult in some specific areas of being a single adult, being a spouse, being a parent, and then ultimately, I don't want to live anymore. How to not give up on life altogether. But this morning, I just want to answer this foundational question. What is it? What does an adult that's winning at adulting look like? If the invitation or the challenge is, okay, fix your eyes on Jesus so that we will not grow weary and lose heart. So be encouraged by him and adult well to the end. What does that look like? And this morning, we're going to learn from one of the greatest men, one of the greatest adults that ever walked this earth, an adult that literally changed the world. In fact, it's no exaggeration to say the majority, if not all of us, are either in this room or watching online because of this man. And his name was Paul. And what's so fascinating about Paul is that this was a man that about 20 years earlier had devoted every waking moment to destroying the Jesus movement. He had gotten permission to go in and arrest Christians and have them imprisoned and have them killed. In fact, there's an account where a Christian is being stoned to death and they're laying their cloaks at his feet so they can get more range of motion as they're chunking these rocks. This was Saul, whose name was changed to Paul, because he's going around having these Christians in prison and executed, but then he has this life-altering moment that changes everything. Literally, while traveling to imprison more followers of Jesus, he has a dramatic encounter with the resurrected Jesus. And for a while after that, he goes into seclusion, and then he spends a few years with just learning from those and listening to, kind of locked in rooms with those that were closest to, who had followed Jesus and heard his word, learning as much as he could from these that had spent time with Jesus before the crucifixion and after the resurrection. All this time learning all that he could of what Jesus said and taught, all the details of his life, his trial, his execution, and the more than a month that Jesus spent walking around and interacting with individuals after his resurrection. And then after this time, then Paul devotes his entire life to spreading the good news of Jesus Christ. And so he travels the entire Mediterranean rim, and he's sharing this good news, sharing exciting news that God has offered us new life. And he's offered us a chance to finally be at peace with God, with our Creator. And God actually blessed Paul with some amazing spiritual gifts and abilities to help reinforce his message, the truth of it. And as people came to know and believe, then he would organize them, these new understanders, these new believers, these new followers of the way, into little, what the Greek word is, ekklesias, communities, movements. We would use the term church. And he appoints leaders. And then he would move on to the next place, and he would share the good news of Jesus Christ. Then he would organize these regional churches, and he kept repeating this process. Now, about 25 years after the resurrection of Jesus, Paul writes a letter to a church that he had planted about 5 years earlier. And this church was in the Greek port city of Corinth. And when you think Corinth, you need to think Vegas. You need to think Sin City times 10. This was a city that was known for its wealth and its power, especially wealth and pleasure, especially sexual pleasure. In fact, Corinth was known for its temple to Aphrodite, which was the goddess of love. This particular temple employed over 1,000 prostitutes at a time. And so you have these new believers. They've grown up in this pagan wealth and pleasure-focused culture. I know it's hard to imagine there could ever be a culture focused on self and personal pleasure. Which is why this is so relevant to us, because like us, they're struggling, because they are surrounded by, they've grown up in, they live in a culture focused on self and personal pleasure. And so you've got these young spiritual, followers of Jesus, and they're learning an entirely new paradigm of how to relate to one another and how to relate to God. And in a sense, they were like children just starting out. They're immature. And so in 1 Corinthians 13, Paul writes these words: "When I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. But when I became a man, I put the ways of childhood behind me." And it's like, okay, Paul, that's great, but what does that mean? I mean, specifically, what does it look like to put the ways of childhood behind me, to become a man, to become a woman, to become an adult, and to do it well? How do I transition from childhood and face those rigors and challenges and obstacles and the striving of adulthood and win? How do I do this in such a way that not only I'm winning, but the people around me, people that I love and care about, that they are winning? That somehow society is winning? And the answer is found just a few verses earlier, because you have to look at this passage in context. Because before Paul says, "When I became a man, I put the ways of childhood behind me," Paul writes words that most of you, if not all of you in this room, you're familiar with. You've heard them before. Either you've heard them in the context of the church, or if you've gone to a wedding where there was a Christian pastor and he used Bible verses, then you've heard these. But seven verses earlier, Paul writes this. In verse 4, love is. Okay, time out. I thought you were talking about adulting. Like, why are you talking about love? I thought you were talking about adulting, and we are. Because Paul is about to contrast, he's about to compare and contrast the ways of childhood versus the ways of adulting. He writes, "Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It's not proud. It doesn't dishonor others. It's not self-seeking. It's not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. In fact, love does not delight in evil, but rejoices in truth." Now again, what does that have to do with adulting? Well, everything. Because let me flip it. How many of you have ever been around a two-year-old? Okay, just five of you? Okay, all right. So it's like, I don't even want to admit. Okay, how many from your personal experience would describe a two-year-old as patient? Yeah, one of the kids like, yeah. How many of you have been around a three-year-old who saw a toy that they wanted in the possession of another child? and they did not envy. Or they were not easily angered, and they could not have that. I mean, if you've ever had the pleasure of trying to take a toy from another child so that they could share it with another one, see how well that goes. It does not end well. There's usually screaming and blood and tears. You know, see, when you look at Paul's description here is the antithesis in each of these descriptive characteristics, because the one represents this is how a child responds. And now he's explained this is how an adult responds. You know, it's just, you know, think about it. When you, you know, look at Paul's description, you know, for those of you that grew up with siblings, you know, did you or they ever have a real good reason you just needed to irritate each other, you know, or to be competitive with one another? No, you didn't, but you were right. I mean, you just did it. How many of you are familiar with the purple dinosaur named as Barney? Yeah, okay. Well, Barney came out when our boys were little, and they watched it nonstop, in which we didn't mind at all because it gave us some peace and quiet. So, you know, here, watch Barney. But at one point, of course, they all reached the age where they would be mortified if anybody knew that they watched Barney. And so I remember when our boys were growing up, from time to time, they would just begin irritating each other, like in a public place or in the store. And so I deployed a tactic. I just figured it out. So here they are. You know, they're annoying one another, which, of course, annoyed me. And so instead of getting mad and yelling at them in just a really loud way, I would just simply go, "Now, boys, let's be friends. I will be your friend." Man, I'm telling you, immediate peace and quiet. And as a dad, that's all we want is peace and quiet, right? So it's just, the response was magical. So they'd scatter like roaches. But Paul's pointing out something that is somewhat obvious, but it's crucial. It's somewhat obvious, but it's a crucial contrast, because as children, our nature is to put ourselves first, our wants, our desires, to put others after us, to even use people as a means to our end. You know, suddenly, you know, one of your kids is being really nice to you, and then they make that request. You know, it's like, "Why are you being nice to me?" "Well, I was wondering if I could go over to so-and-so." "What?" You know, so we'll use people for a means. Talk about holding a grudge. And this is Paul's point. He's contrasting childish behavior with what it means to grow up and to be mature and to adult well. Because here's the thing. If we take just those few verses that I read from 1 Corinthians and apply those three rich verses to our life and our relationships, it is a game changer. It will change and transform everything. Just try it. Test me. Because in fact, some of you could tell your story. You and I could sit over coffee or some other beverage, and you could tell me how your life is different. Because as you were growing up, you had a man or a woman, you had men or women in your life, and they adulted by these principles. There were adults in your life, they were just so patient with you. You know, you had adults that shaped you because they were so kind to you. You look forward to every time you could just be with them. You just loved to be in their presence because you had in your life adults that were just so selfless, or they were not easily angered. Even when you messed up, it's like they kept no record of wrongs, and they just seemed to forgive you. And because of that, you didn't just want to be around them, but you wanted to be like them. Their words carried weight in your life because they were adulting well. Or you had a teacher or a boss. And even when you screwed up, you tripped, you fell, you know, you dropped the ball. Instead of bringing the hammer down on you, they came alongside you, and they used it as an opportunity to just come alongside you to help you, lift you back up, to dust you off, and help you grow in your role or your industry. For some of you, it's the opposite. Some of you, what you could tell me is that some of your deepest scars, some of your deepest wounds, some of the things that can seem to continue to hinder you in your ability to live life, to love, to have a relationship, maybe in the workplace, is because a mom or a dad or a teacher or some influential adult in your life was just so impatient with you. Or you just always felt the pressure. You never felt like you were quite measuring up. Or their tongue was a flamethrower and they just burned you with their words. Or they were so unkind to you. Or even a compliment, if they gave one, was a backhanded compliment. "Well, you know, your C- is better than the D of last year." Or you had a teacher or a boss or a coworker who was just so self-absorbed they just made your life a living hell. So you begin to see Paul's point. because you see how love, or the absence of love, is the defining attribute of adulting well or adulting poorly. And again, in fact, if you think about it, the thing we all long for, a deep, abiding sense of contentment and peace, has been dramatically and directly impacted by the adults in your life and how they treated you growing up, and even how they treat you now. And we know this is true, which means that there are people, for those of us that are adults, there are people that are close to us, and they are being dramatically and directly impacted by us and how we treat them. And so this is why we want to pay close attention to Paul's next four key words, that, which define for us how to adult well. And they're in verse 7. So here's what he says, and I want to look at each of these separately in the time that remains. Love, or adulting well, it always protects, always trusts, always hopes, and always perseveres. And within this one verse, Paul gives us four defining, applicable characteristics that helps us know how to adult well. Each one of these, you could walk out of here today, you could log off, you can walk away, and you can begin to apply these to how you are living your life as an adult. The first is, as an adult, we're to protect. And to some degree, we get this, right? It's in our nature. I mean, if you ever want to put this to the test, just mess with somebody's child, right? Especially in front of mom. Because I'm telling you, my boys are grown, strong men, plenty capable of taking care of themselves, but threaten to harm them or insult them either in any way. And I'm telling you, my 5'2", buck 15 wife will drop you and bless you in Jesus' name on the way down. It's just like, you know, or you harm or threaten my wife, and this smile goes away, and a very different Chad will come out. A very different version emerges, because and the level of danger is irrelevant. There's nothing that I would hold back, including my life, in order to protect my wife or somebody I love. And I believe the same is true of you as well. So we understand this idea. But tragically, I've known and I've worked with children and young people, even older adults, they didn't have this growing up. Instead, they grew up in homes where the adults didn't protect. And in fact, in some cases, the adults were the perpetrators of hurt and harm and even violence and unspeakable violations of the mind, body, and spirit. And they carry such pain and there's such confusion because innately they gravitated towards the adult looking for them to protect them, because there's something in a child that knows that's what an adult should do. So we get this idea of protecting. We even admire it when we see it. And most of us are appalled when we see abuses, which affirms that we already know innately inside of us what winning as an adult means, and that is that we take a posture to protect those that can't protect themselves, or just to protect people that we love, to guard. But this is important. Protecting doesn't just mean that we live like a bodyguard in kind of an ongoing passive state, but where we're at the ready to take the hit, the blast, the bullet for someone else. Yes, that's part of it, but that day may never come. However, what is guaranteed is that we are surrounded by people that matter to us, people that do matter to God, and they are going to be attacked daily by things that are going to attack their heart, their mind, their body, and their spirit. You know, as a man, one of my greatest joys is to serve as a guard of my wife's heart, mind, body, and spirit. And again, we'll talk more about what that looks like when we come to in a couple of weeks with I Don't Want a Spouse Anymore. But at its core, it means I pay attention to the challenges that she's facing from within and from the outside. I work to know her strengths, her hopes, her dreams, as well as her weaknesses, her insecurities, her vulnerable places, so that I do what I can to come alongside her, to help her to not overcommit, because I know my wife's limitations, and that if she commits to one more thing, she'll begin to get burned out, to support and encourage her pursuit of physical health and encourage her in her pursuit of exercise and eating healthy. There's been times where I've intervened as her husband just because I can tell she's stretching herself too thin and she's getting burned out. Or on a regular basis, I'll plan even months ahead where either to get her away with some friends, just get her out of town, or for us to get away, just the two of us, to have that time to refresh mind, body, and spirit, because I want to protect and I want to guard her heart, her mind, her body, and her soul. And in order to protect an older child in my life, I'm not just going to give them a smartphone in which they can access everything the internet has to offer, because some of the things that the internet has to offer can destroy them. And so there are people in my life, there are people in your life, family members, friends, coworkers, that God has positioned you in a very, very special way to serve as a guardian, to serve as a protector of their heart, their mind, their body, their spirit, which is one of the reasons we are so annoyingly persistent at New Life Wichita of trying to get people into small groups and into community, because so that you're not doing a life alone. Because in order for somebody to be able to help guard and protect your spirit, there has to be proximity. And for you to have the ability to help protect, guard, and watch over someone else, there has to be proximity. And it's the reason why we started New Life Wichita, because we want to operate in this community as protectors. The second thing is, an adult, we're to trust. Trust who? God's texting me. Let me turn that off. We're to trust God, our Heavenly Father. Going back to what we looked at in the week one, James, the half-brother of Jesus, when he writes this: if any of you lacks wisdom, so you've got a question, you've got an issue, you've got a challenge, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. But when you ask, you must believe and not doubt, because the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. That person should not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Why? Because that person is double-minded and unstable in all that they do. So let me describe it this way. Have you ever told somebody that you 100% knew to be true and accurate, only to have them question you? And it'd be so frustrating. And you just want to say, just trust me. And it's like God is saying, just trust me. I am not as dumb as you think. I'm God. And you're not. I created the universe. I created you. I'm the source. I'm the origin of all things. And I'm not limited by space and time. And so because of all of that, and because I love you, I have a perspective that you don't. And you can trust my perspective. I will never lie to you. I will never mislead you. So what that means is, when it comes to how we live our life, how we handle our life, our heart, our soul, our strength, our mind, our relationship, how we adult, God is the true north. That when he gives instruction or direction, that we trust him, and then we make our trust complete by obedience. We don't just say, I believe you, God, but I'm going to go do this. We make it complete by our obedience. That means we pray, God, I have this desire or this dilemma. What should I do about this? And God gives an answer. Do this, don't do that. Or maybe the answer is wait, not yet. And our automatic response needs to not be, thank you, God. I don't really like option A. Could I have option B? It's no, God, how should I handle my sexuality? How should I handle my money? How should I handle this person that hurt me? God, how honest should I be? How should I handle my influence over the lives of the people around me, or power that I've been given? How should I handle my time? And just as a little side note, to be clear, there are a lot of questions that we ask God that he has already answered before, through those that have gone before us. Because what I mean is that we can get into the pages of the New Testament, and the answers are there to basically any question that you could have about money, sex, and power, and being faithful to God, and honoring to Jesus, and how to live a life that is truly life. In fact, in my own life, I have recognized that there are times that I am praying about something only to sense God's response to be, in a loving and compassionate way, Chad, I've already answered these questions. I've already answered this question. In fact, you've read it before. In fact, you may have memorized it. What it's really coming down to is, you're not liking my answer. See, in those situations or seasons where we're struggling or tested, we have to decide ahead of time that no matter what, God, I'm going to trust you. I'm going to do it your way. I'm going to trust that in the end, it will end well. And through our example and in our words, we are showing and demonstrating, teaching the next generation how to do the same. The third, as an adult, we're to hope. Well, what does that mean? What it means is that we refuse to allow ourselves to be convinced that there is no hope. We refuse to give up because we believe there is no purpose in whatever circumstance or whatever challenge that we are facing, refuse to believe there is no potential for good in whatever it is that we're facing. We refuse to let ourselves to be like a child that, when they feel frustrated, they drop down to the ground and have a tantrum, or they just drop down in defeat because things aren't going their way. that we no longer just let emotions and feelings run the show, as James says, because then it will be like, we'll just be like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. Instead, we determine in our mind that whatever we are facing, it has a purpose. If we're facing a financial challenge, a health challenge, a relational challenge, that whatever it is, a parenting challenge, a marriage challenge, that whatever it is, that beyond this challenge, whatever it is, that the way we handle it matters, and handling our race and running our race and that God has marked out for us and the way that he would have us do it will result in something greater than we could ask or imagine. Because as Paul says in one of his other letters, if God is for us, who can be against us? And to emphasize, he says, he didn't spare his own son, but he gave him up for us all. If he did that, how will he not also, along with him, graciously give us what we long for? Which leads to the fourth and final thing. As an adult, we're to persevere. And what that means is we never stop protecting. If you're not dead, you're not done. We never stop trusting. We never stop hoping. Because it isn't just our life, and life in this life, life after this life at stake. Because if we give up, if we walk away, we're not the only ones impacted. And again, many of you have experienced this firsthand. Because one or both of your parents couldn't bring themselves, for example, to run the race of marriage God's way, and they gave up on the marriage. And your family blew up. And you're still dealing with the shrapnel of that. Or maybe you were married to someone. And they were determined, I will not run the race of marriage the way God would have me run the race of marriage. And they broke your heart. Some of you grew up in homes with adults that gave up on their role in your life and you have never fully recovered. And so for many of you, you know from your own life, the life of others, that the ripple effect of not adulting well, for some of you, you just know the damages it causes. And for some of us, we know the damage that we've caused. I know some of the damages that I've caused at the times that I did not handle adulting well because I did not operate by these principles. I decided to do it my way. And here's a summarizing profound statement of fact that Paul makes to us. Love never fails. Love never fails. Now, at first glance, for some of you, it's hard to fully believe because every single one of us have experienced failed love. But if we really dig down, if we really are honest, it wasn't love that failed, it was a person. It wasn't love that failed, it was someone else. Maybe it was us, but love never fails. And so it's important to grasp the magnitude of what Paul is saying because he's expressing the core of our soul. Because here's the thing, we don't want to fail. That's the thing that's driving us. We don't want to be a failure. We don't want to fail in life. We don't want to fail in our finances or in our relationships or our careers. We want to win. We want to succeed. So after you leave here this morning, after you log off, here's where you apply this. Who is it that God has put in your life to protect? To help be a guardian, to help be a protector of their heart, of their mind, of their body, their spirit. Where's an area where you have been resisting God's calling? There's something that you've been praying about, a challenge you've been facing, and you've been holding back, and you keep praying about it, and it's time for you to trust. Have you found yourself struggling or drowning in a circumstance? And it's time for you to let some other people into your life and into your situation to renew your hope. And where is it that you know God's way, and you know the best way, and in fact, as you examine your life, you feel like, I am doing it God's way. I'm being obedient. But I'm getting tired. I'm getting kind of weary of doing it God's way because it's not having the results that I expected. And it's time to be refreshed and strengthened by those that have gone before you or those that are traveling the same road and let them walk alongside you and to focus on Jesus so that you can renew your perseverance and not give up. Let's pray. Father, I pray for all of us in this room, those that are listening, and God, that you truly would strengthen us, that you truly, especially in a culture and a time where there can be so much confusion about what it means to be a man or a woman and masculinity, is it good or bad, and all these confusing voices, Father, and I pray that you would help us to push all the noise away and that you truly would help us to see Jesus as he was, not just some long-haired, pale, nice guy going around telling people to be nice. He was strong. He was courageous. He was bold. And he showed us a love that the world had never experienced before. He showed us what it meant to be an adult, a man, a woman that protects and trusts and hopes and perseveres. And I pray, God, that for each one of us. In the name of Jesus, amen.